They've watched Citizen Kane a combined 200 times. Elliot's first words were, "I personally thought the use of Dutch angles was derivative in the 400 blows." In Nathan's favorite historical figure is Fritz Lang. Now they're bringing that snootiness to you with Magellan's at the Movies.
Hey, welcome back, friends, Romans, countrymen, listeners of all ages, to Magellan's at the Movies. This is your co-host coming at you pre-recorded, Elliot Magaliens, joined as always by my co-host and brother in arms and in blood, Nathan Magaliens. It's hard to pronounce that name. Nathan Megalopolis, it is almost upon us. I think the reviews right now are like split right down the middle between positive and negative. And Francis Ford Coppola is on whatever the exact opposite of a charm offensive is, to ensure.
A smarm offensive.
That's good. So Francis Ford Coppola is on a smarm offensive where he's like, my movies are very prescient. The American Republic will fall in the next 3 months. And this, nobody understands my work. When you really think about it, like I'm pretty much Jesus, but with movies. That's basically me. Is kind of the character of Coppola's recent comments. I don't even know at this point if people are asking him these questions or if he's just like shooting them out on tweets. Like it just occurs to him, oh, you know what? I bet in 3 months. America won't be a democracy anymore. I gotta write this down. Tell someone about it.
I'm not gonna defend Francis Ford Coppola's behavior on his press tour for Megalopolis. I will say, nothing I've seen about Megalopolis makes me any less excited to see this movie. I am desperately, desperately anticipating watching this. Everything I've seen says that regardless of how you feel about the quality of the movie, it is an experience unlike any other in terms of watching. I've seen a lot of people compare it to like going to see The Room in theaters, for better or for worse, that it's that level of like enjoyment of just kind of like mind-boggling creative decisions. And like you said, Elliot, it's split right down the center in terms of people enjoying that and finding that to be very compelling and interesting. People that think, this guy is just really acting like he's all that in a bag of chips, and he's just the air in the bag of chips, you know. But I'm so, so excited to see this movie. I really, I'm hoping to see it sometime, maybe this weekend. But as soon as I see it, you, the listeners, will hear my thoughts on it. Elliot, are you planning on seeing it, or has the smarm offensive put you off?
I am planning on seeing it, although I'm a skeptic here. And yep. I'm more than happy to be proven wrong. Like I did not expect much from Alien Romulus, and that movie surprised me. So let it never be said that I go into movies with a foregone conclusion. But all of the negative reviews of this movie have just described my movie nightmare. And all of the positive reviews have just been word salads of that basically boiled down to, man, that was wild, which is also my movie nightmare. So I'm not hopeful.
Wow.
Also, did Coppola just choose random Roman names out of a hat for these people? Because the antagonist is the mayor is named Cicero, and Cicero is far from being like a tyrannical evil figure. Roman history.
Certainly nothing like Nero or Caligula, people who have just nasty names.
I mean, even naming the protagonist Caesar is a little weird.
Well, it's a bit on the... my sense of the movie is that everything is a bit on the... that, like, nothing in the film is a super subtle wink, wink, nudge, nudge. It's all... as in your face as it possibly can be.
Well, I just finished reading a big book about ancient Roman history.
Of course you did.
And I don't know, it's kind of like heightened my consciousness that I'm like, they keep on coming out with names and I'm like, I know who that's probably named after. What is the relationship between the historical figure and their movie counterpart?
Yeah. Well, I don't know if you saw, I saw a list of like every like piece of work that Coppola felt inspired him in writing the movie. And you'd have to take like a PhD program in philosophy and history to have read all of the books that he listed. I mean, he's everything from Machiavelli's Prince to the writings of Virgil to Descartes, to Hume, to Kant. I mean, he was all, you know, the Art of War. It was insane. Like, I consider myself to be a fairly well-read individual. I'm a man of the word, the written word, that is.
A man of letters is what that's called.
And there, like 70% of these books were things that I had not read, was not familiar.
Well, don't sell yourself short, Nathan. I would not be surprised whatsoever if someone actually asked Francis Ford like an in-depth question about some of those books, and he was like, "What?" And it came to light that he hadn't actually read them and just like read.
I'm not going to sit here and take that. I don't think that's true. I think he's read them. Whether or not he's understood them, I mean, I think Zack Snyder has read Atlas Shrugged. I don't think he's fully grasped, or maybe anyway.
Maybe he's grasped it too well. Dude, I've only read one book by Ayn Rand. I really disliked it.
All right. Anyway, shifting our focus to another smarmy director who we don't like. We are covering today Avatar. This was a request from our brother by marriage, Davis Cowens. This is, I guess, his favorite movie. If I had known that before he entered the family, I might have fought harder to keep him out of the family.
And but, you already fought pretty hard.
I did not. That's a joke. Maybe that spoiled a bit of my feelings on this movie, but we are talking about James Cameron's 2009 global smash. I don't know exactly where it falls in terms of the highest grossing movies of all time. At one point, it was number one. I think it might still be number one. It might have reclaimed the number one spot from Avengers Endgame following its re-release before its sequel's release. But yeah, if you don't know, Avatar is the story of Jake Sully, a Marine who's been injured and lost the use of his legs, who has shipped out to the alien world of Pandora, and because his brother was going to go there, and then he died, and his brother was part of the Avatar program. So they created kind of clone versions of the native population, the Na'vi, and the people can link into it using some science mumbo jumbo. And so he's an avatar, he's the avatar. and it follows them in a storyline you would never be able to predict. A truly original, wildly imaginative sort of... Okay, anyway. Elliot, let's get to some first thoughts here. Some substantive things instead of just generic ribbing on the film. Let's get to some substantive discussion here. What are your opening thoughts? What's your history with this film?
Well, first of all, I just want to say that that plot summary left out the best part of the movie by far. And that's that Jake's brother was recruited to this at the site of his... So Jake was recruited to this as his brother was being cremated right in front of him. Like, I don't know how this happened, but they decided, hey, let's have this meeting at the crematorium as your brother's body is being wheeled into the oven. Dude, that gave me a good chuckle. Job, James. Yeah, so I've only seen this movie once before. Let's take a little stroll down memory lane back to a year. I can't remember, but when I was young, Nathan and I were both young, and we were invited to a screening of this movie that our father was putting on for one of his college classes.
Yep.
And I won't speak for you here, Nathan, but I was like, oh my gosh, I'm invited to an adult party. With an adult movie, like, let's do this.
It's PG-13.
Okay, well, I was young. I think I was, in middle school or something. But then again, I think that every time I've talked about watching a movie in the past, I've said, I think I was in middle school.
You did a lot in middle school.
I did. I really got around. But anyway. Yeah, and that first viewing, obviously, is so far in the past that I really can't say much about it. All I know is that since then, every time I thought back on the movie or I saw clips or I read about it, I was like, man, that movie wasn't too good. But I've always wondered, like, is that true? Do I actually think that? What would happen if I sat down and watched it again? So last night, I watched this movie after doing all my work. I had a pizza. It was 7 o'clock at night. There was a soft rain going on. I stacked the deck in this movie's favor. That is ideal movie watching conditions for me. So I don't want anyone to say oh, you didn't like it because you're in the bad mood. I don't know who would, but for my own sake, I know that I truly dislike this movie, and it has nothing to do with my attitude or my disposition or anything like that, because I stacked the deck in this movie's favor and I slipped it a couple of aces just to be sure, and it still failed me. I didn't leave this movie fuming in the way that I left The Way of Water, where after The Way of Water, I was like, what a waste of time that movie was. This movie is definitely a waste of time, albeit a slightly less offensive one. There's no single problem that I can think of that undercuts this movie. There are definitely some major ones and some minor ones, but none that are the death blow for this movie. It really is death by a thousand cuts. The story is, we are far from the first people to say this, or I won't speak for you, Nathan. Again, I am far from the first person to say this. This movie's story is painfully unoriginal. Its characters are incredibly bland. I very much did not care for the antagonists. I thought they were terrible. It's quite boring. The Na'vi are so much about this movie is just lame. The Na'vi's culture is just this really lame amalgamation of stereotypical Native American iconography and the traditional Hollywoodified depiction of Native American mysticism. And that's so uninteresting because, when you're talking about an alien culture, let's go the road of Arrival and have it be just unrecognizable. That's the kind of stuff that interests me. But no, they're just like Comanche, but weird. And that's how I would describe a lot of this movie. This movie's like special effects. It's got rhinos, but weird. Horses, but weird. Monkeys, but weird. Panthers, but weird. It's very unimaginative. And the reason I'm getting bogged down into this is because that extends to so much of this movie. It's just unimaginative, paint by numbers, tropes and cliches. And by the end of the movie, I was very ready for it to be done. And when it was over, I wasn't celebrating, but I was like, I think maybe that's going to be the last time I ever watch this movie. So that was my initial impression.
Oh, no way. I didn't realize you were also at that screening. I remember it maybe a little bit better than you because I was maybe a little bit older. I remember being very, very bored.
You've been a little bit older for my entire life, so there's a good chance of that, yeah.
I remember being very, very bored, but I remember really enjoying the final battle sequence when things were actually happening, which maybe speaks to my maturity level when I watched this film. I guess I should say that we did not watch this in theaters in 3D, which maybe would change how I felt about it. I will also say I didn't see Star Wars in theaters in the 70s. That movie still, you know, excites me and is an incredibly enjoyable, exciting experience to me. So I think if a movie's only good in a certain, watched a certain way, I would say that's just not a very good movie. That, you know, maybe the setting's what's good, not the movie. But I think you hit the nail absolutely on the head for two things. One, this made me hate The Way of Water even more, because for everything that this movie is, at the very least, it's not as boring and stupid and poorly written as The Way of Water. As well as, yeah, there's like a million things that I think are worse in The Way of Water than in this movie. And I think you absolutely hit it on the head in a second way by saying that the movie's greatest
sin. Two for two. Right here.
You're killing it. The movie's greatest sin is it's uninteresting. That nothing in this movie creates in me a desire to think about it more. And I think given how many people go to see it in theaters but then never talk about it afterwards, or how little sort of discourse the movie creates, I think is indicative of just a lack of interesting concepts. And yeah, like you said, Elliot, the story is painfully generic. That's 100% true. I don't see how you can possibly defend the movie from that charge. I was reading the trivia on IMDb, and it said James Cameron got the idea after watching Disney's animated Pocahontas movie. And I was like, wow, no way. He's got to be fibbing. There's so many other movies about like this sort of concept. And this has got to be the least interesting and least engaging one of all of those movies. I don't know if it's become apparent to our listeners as they've been listening and following this podcast, but an interesting idea in a movie gets the movie really, really far for me. Like, if the movie has something that I find engaging or intriguing or novel or in any way sort of a new way of looking at a thing, I'm going to rate that movie really high, even if there's other components to it that I think are subpar. Because I think the whole thing about movies is that you're going to see something new that broadens your horizons or broadens your mind. And this is like the movie version of not doing that. I don't like, there's so little in the movie that is exciting to me, is interesting to me, and that's with it, like you said. I mean, it's got some it's got some cards in the deck that it's science fiction. I love science fiction. It's a movie that spends a lot of time with its world and with its kind of lore of the environment that it exists in, which is, I love that you brought up Arrival, because I think that's one of the perfect examples of a movie that spends so much time with a very complicated sort of lore that I think they do a really, really fantastic job of introducing to the audience and explaining to the audience in a way that is helpful. And this movie just feels like the least interesting episode of Animal Planet that you could possibly watch. That, yeah, none of the animal species are exciting or cool or novel or in any way look like something I haven't seen a gajillion times before. None of the characters are interesting. Yeah, it's just not. I don't like this movie very much. Although, again, I would agree also with your statement that I don't hate it. Like, if someone forced me to watch The Way of Water again, I would hate that. I would dislike that person quite a bit. If someone forced me to watch Avatar again, I'd be a little irked. But I wouldn't, like, there are different levels. Like, this movie is just uninteresting. It's not as aggressively bad as I think the sequel is.
All right, well, we are in lockstep with each other for the most part. I would like to start with the plot. And that will kind of take us in different directions to characters and world building and stuff like that. Because I think that the plot of this movie is very generic, and that's not something that should be overlooked. But it's also kind of stupid. And what I mean is, like, this is the second time, I think, on this program that we've watched a movie that has moved me to take notes, so I would remember wow. all the things that I was thinking. And there were a lot of moments where I was just noting down things that don't make sense or don't come back to impact the story in any way, shape, or form. I'll just run through a couple examples here. Initially, Jake is kind of, he's Team Marines. And so he's hanging out with evil general guy whose name I can't remember.
Quaritch.
Quaritch. Oh man, Dark. Curse you, Quaritch.
Papa Dragon.
Yes, I'm going to call him Papa Dragon. So he's hanging out with Papa Dragon. That's the best line of the movie, by the way. It's just Papa Dragon. I want this mission high and tight. I want to be home for dinner. Pure Shakespeare. Jake is hanging out with Papa Dragon, who's just your typical army bad guy. And so he's kind of the man on the inside for them, for the Marines. Or the army. I'm not sure if they are Marines. They're just like the army or something. And at one point, Jake narrates, because he does this a lot, and it annoyed the heck out of me. The narration in this movie is so lame. It's not like Red's narration in Shawshank Redemption, where it's fairly consistent and it's kind of bringing you closer to Red's character. Dude, no. The narration in this movie is purely to get across exposition that James Cameron couldn't be bothered to subtly insert. So Jake starts narrating that he's like, oh, Grace knows that I'm working with Quaritch, but she knows that also that I'm the only person who can get her in to the tribe. And when that happened, when that line came, I was like, dude, what? That is a major gamble on her part that is not being addressed whatsoever. And the same thing happens with the tribe. What are they called? Like the Omatekiako?
Oh, I have no idea, dude. Come on now. You're asking me to remember details of the plot?
The Blue
the
Man.
After, the night after I watched it? That's insane.
The Blue Man Group. He's sure. The only person who could get them into the Blue Man Group. When Jake first arrives at Blue Man Group headquarters and the chief is debating whether or not to let him stay, he says we need to learn more about the sky people, which is what they call the humans, from him. So that's why I'll let him stay. And again, major gamble on his part. And it never comes back. Like, no one ever asks him, hey, man, what are the sky people doing? What can we expect? So that doesn't make a whole lot of sense. Oh, my gosh. Where's the other one? Why do all the animals have separate orifices for eating and breathing? That's a good question.
That's, you asked the question.
Yes.
Well, I guess I would add one that they kind of introduced early in the movie. Well, not, yeah, kind of early in the movie, that there's another scientist who also arrives on the same ship with Jake, who is part of the Avatar program. I think his name is Norm. And they kind of established early in the movie that, or at least I felt they established, that Norm was jealous of Jake and Jake's, like, ability. Elliot's nodding, so I take it that I'm not reading into things. And this also, yeah, goes nowhere. Never does Norm do something that impacts the plot in any way, shape, or form. He's just kind of always along for the ride doing that.
Well, I mean, there's barely a resolution also for the conflict between Jake and the Na'vi guy who doesn't trust Jake. Because what happens is Jake tames a Turok or something. I can't remember what it's called.
I think that is what it's called.
So he tames a Turok, and then everyone just forgives him. And that's it. It's like they snap their fingers and all is forgiven. And it's so unsatisfying because Jake didn't do anything particularly cool for this. Like, he jumps off of his pterodactyl and lands on the Turok and it cuts to black. So we don't even get to see what happened there. And his plan is like, oh, I guess it won't see me if I attack from above. So I guess up until now, the Na'vi have just been coming at it straight on. And been like,
well, they don't attack it. It's the apex predator. They would never have a reason to attack it. Although if that's the method by which you can get on it to ride it, I feel like that is a fairly simple... I mean, how else would you even get to it? From below to ride it on its back? Yeah, I don't know,
maybe you could smuggle yourself into its nest by disguising yourself as a baby Turok.
That's a good idea, Elliot.
They should look into that. But anyway, the point is that the reason they forgive him is because there's just like they, the tribe has some kind of mythical respect, mythical level respect for people who can tame Turoks. And that's just a really unsatisfying way to resolve this conflict, is to just have this one line mentioning that, oh, it's really hard to tame Turoks. Only 5 people have done it. If someone did that, I would think they were really, really cool. That's not the actual line, although that's kind of the gist. And then have Jake just do that and all is forgiven by magic, in a very literal sense. Because this is kind of prophesized, or the spirit, this indicates spiritual favor or something, rather than having it come about by some kind of gesture of sincerity on Jake's part, or him making some kind of great personal sacrifice for them that proves his sincerity. I mean, all of those things are a lot more moving and a lot more significant than what is circuitous method of, he kind of leapfrogs their suspicion by using the Turok. Nothing has changed in their attitudes or the reality of the situation. He's just kind of found a get-out-of-jail-free card. And that's lame. That's lame, James. And before you send us an email asking how many successful movies we've made, the answer is none, okay? Neither of us have ever made or done anything as successful as you have.
I mean, I wish I could make terrible movies except for Titanic and Aliens and be very successful. That would be great. What Jake should have done, Elliot, is he should have saved someone's children from getting hit by a car driven by a friend of the family on drugs. Then they would have forgiven him. And you would have accepted that.
Yes.
It's a bit of a callback to a previous episode. I don't have a ton to add there because I think you're absolutely correct. I would like to add that when Neytiri is describing the Turok and she says they call it the last shadow, Jake says, oh, like it's the last shadow you'll ever see. Or like he restates the meaning of the name as if it's not obvious. And that feels to me indicative of the way James Cameron writes this entire movie, that the narration is there to make sure everyone in the audience, including the guy who's been asleep for 16 minutes and has just kind of like been startled awake by a creature roaring, is able to follow this incredibly simple plot. And I don't want to be mean here, okay? I think, you know, critics who maybe go out of their way to just bully people, I think that's kind of bad. I mean, someone making bad art doesn't mean that they're like a bad person or that they deserve personal attacks. But I will say, watching this movie, I think it's very obvious why Sam Worthington did not become a huge movie star. I don't think he's particularly charismatic. I don't think this character is necessarily written to be very charismatic. I don't think the script is helping him in any way. But I mean, some of the line readings here are just rough. It feels like a very aggressively jock character in a way that's not interesting. Like, at no point does it feel like we ever learn anything about Jake that's interesting, or I don't want to keep saying how uninteresting this movie is, but Jake is just such a nothing of a character. And Sam Worthington and the script are doing nothing to elevate that sort of element. Also, some of the narration at the beginning feels like they used the first take that, like, they handed Sam the script, and then they used his first take where he was, like, confused about lines, that he's like, oh, and then we avatar into the bodies, and they're like, that's perfect, we'll use that. Like, Jake sounds confused. Like, he sounds confused by what he's reading. And it makes no sense. Why would he be confused in narration? So yeah, the narration's terrible. The exposition, I mean, beyond just the narration, the movie has heap loads of uninteresting exposition. It feels like, from between this movie and the sequel, all James Cameron really wanted to do was make giant, pretty CGI nonsense and then shoot his camera around in that. It doesn't feel like he really wanted to write a story for either of these movies, and that's why we get the non-story that is here. I mean, I pivot to start talking about some of the characters, but there's nothing to any of these people. Quaritch, like you said, is a generic military bad guy. If you've seen a military bad guy in any other movie, you get the gist. There's like a corporate bad guy who wants unobtainium, which is a stupid name for a MacGuffin. There's Michelle Rodriguez as a Michelle Rodriguez type, who, again, very little interesting or engaging about her character. It's kind of shocking that this is the same guy who did Aliens, which I think does such an amazing job of characterizing a lot of people who do very little in the film, in terms of the colonial marines that are accompanying Ripley. Speaking of Ripley, Sigourney Weaver is in it as Grace, a scientist who kind of made me want to not be in science. The scientists are really, like, mean to Jake for no reason. Like, they're very much lording the fact that they know more than him over him. I also kind of dislike her saying that the Na'vi's religion thing, that she's like, oh, it's not some pagan nonsense. I kind of dislike the implication that your religion is only legitimate if it's based in science, and that having kind of like a faith that's based in something a little less scientific is therefore worthy of derision and scorn, or it would be fine for the corporation to just be steamrolling these people if they had a religion that was based in something different. So I don't like her. There's Norm, who does nothing. There's the other scientist guy, who I recognized him from something. Elliot, you gotta help me. Who's the other scientist guy? The one who, like, discovers that Jake is collaborating with the Marine, or the Army people?
I don't know. His character's name is Max.
Okay, thank you, Elliot. That's really helpful. I need what else the actor is in.
I don't know. I didn't recognize him.
Okay, dang it.
He's in Inception.
Oh yeah, he's the guy who sells them the juice or the fluid that they use to sleep.
I think you're right. He's in The Way of Water. When?
At the beginning. There's some scientist characters at the beginning of it.
Oh. He's also in Drag Me to Hell. Sounds like a good movie.
Sam Raimi.
Well, there you go. There's that little... Now we know.
Okay, wow, thank you. Okay, anyway. Yeah, so all the characters, and then the Na'vi characters, again, very generic. Neytiri is a bad human being, continues to be a bad human being. My biggest issue with
Way
of Water...
She's not a human. So.
Well, she exhibits a poor moral fiber in the second movie, especially. In this one, it's less bad.
But well, yeah, she's just gonna straight up murder Jake in the beginning when he's just walking around, in her eyes, posing no immediate threat to anyone or anything. She's like, I'm gonna kill this guy.
Yeah. But anyway, I think maybe to pivot away from the story and the characters, because I feel like there's very little else that I can say about them. The biggest thing about this movie, I think the biggest talking point and discussion, is the technical elements of the film. So Elliot, did you feel coming back to the movie like it looked, that it still looked very good, and that it still had was like exciting or cool to see this level of technical sort of success on screen?
Well, first of all, related to the technical elements, I just want to say this movie drags and drops sound effects from Jurassic Park.
Yeah.
Why did they do that? Because the weird panther has the T-Rex roar, and the horses make the velociraptors like communicative calls. And that is so distracting to me because... First of all, why would you make me think about Jurassic Park? That's going to immediately prompt some unfavorable comparisons. And second of all, those are such recognizable, legendary sound effects. Do they think that they're stealing them? Is it supposed to be a reference?
I have no idea. Because I know in other movies, people use sound effects as a reference. The lasers in Ant-Man are the like AT-AT sounds from Star Wars, and that roly alien thing from Force Awakens uses the same sound effect as the boulder from Indiana Jones, which I think is a very fun Easter egg thing. I have no idea. I don't know. In a movie that has this many different new things, it is kind of weird that they didn't make sounds for those animals.
Well, okay, so the CGI. And this is an area where I will admit to some level of sympathy for this movie because CGI is such an unforgiving, or I should say the progress of CGI is so unforgiving to movies in the past. This is the same thing that kind of happens with video games, although to a lesser extent, because games can still play very well, even if they look poor. But something that looks groundbreaking in Avatar, as everyone says it did, like it's not an uncommon thing to hear that Avatar was breaking new ground in the field of CGI at the time of its release. But today, it just looks fine. And there are even some of the creatures, especially the hyenas, that make the little warbling sound, that look very rubbery, in not a very good way. And some of the shots of the actors, of the avatars, or the Blue Men Group people, when they're acting, I was like, man, the close-up here is not doing much for me because their faces just don't like move quite right. It's almost like they don't have enough like physical muscle range to accommodate the kinds of emotions that they're supposed to be feeling. They're really only conducive to highs, right? Of yelling or laughing. They can't really do subtlety. So, I mean, it's not terrible. And obviously, for 2009, it's very impressive. But I can't honestly give this movie too many points for it because, like, yeah, it's not great. I mean, it is. It's very good. It's not great. And it also contributes to another of this movie's problems that's related to story and characters, that for a extended portion of this movie, when Jake is learning about the Na'vi and their traditions and stuff, I was thinking, this is just digital tourism. This is just a guided tour of a bunch of stuff that doesn't actually exist. And yeah, I mean there it is right there. That is superficiality condensed into its purest form, is the just a greatest hits tour of things that, again, aren't even that impressive or awe-inspiring, because I'm like, this is just ripped from Disney's Pocahontas. Yeah. Also, the score is not great.
Oh yeah, I don't like the score at all. I'm not a huge fan of the score. And yeah, I would agree. I don't think the movie has aged very well. Here's time for my hot take. Whoa. I think I've already told Elliot this, so I think he knows this. I think if we're going to give any one director or one person, if we're forced to give one person credit for kind of setting the tone of the CGI heavy landscapes that we see in film today, if we're going to, firstly, say that that's a good thing, which I don't know if we should, but if we're going to say that that's a good thing and we want to give credit, I'm going to say very loudly and very aggressively that the man is George Lucas, and anyone else is not in the conversation, in my mind. This movie looks worse than Revenge of the Sith. I think Revenge of the Sith looks better than this movie. And I think, Elliot's thinking about that. You get back to me. I think this movie has not aged well. It's aged better than some of its peers, I will admit. But it looks rubbery. I wrote that it kind of looks like Spy Kids in some of the sequences.
Whoa,
that
ouch.
I don't mean in terms of like the CGI was bad. I just mean in terms of like everything being way brighter than I think it should have been. Especially in the scenes in like the corporate headquarters with the holograms, everything just feels too bright in a way that I think lighting is huge when it comes to CGI and stuff. I think lighting is a big reason why, like, The Mandalorian looks as bad as it does, is because the lighting is just way terrible on that show. And I think the lighting is way off in this movie as well. And it just makes the movie unpleasant for me to look at. There's some scenes where it's okay. I think the scene where Jake wakes back up in kind of the ash-strewn remains of Home Tree, I think that's a very visually compelling scene, and like, it looks very good. It's grayed out. Again, the lighting has kind of changed in a way that makes it exciting. And there's some scenes, again, where some of the night scenes look okay, but I think in general, it looks too rubbery. It looks very, like, noticeably CGI. It doesn't look as tactile as something like even the CGI in Pirates of the Caribbean for like Davy Jones, that he looks very tactile. He looks like he has a feel to him. And a lot of the things on Pandora don't look like they have a feel. They look like just a CGI glob. And I read once that Pandora looks like a world that was designed by production designers and not by anyone with any grasp of how things should actually look, like not a botanist. Yeah. No, but not like a botanist or a zoologist or something. And I think that's a good thing for some people, that they think that looks very creatively imaginative. I think it just looks like a bunch of nonsense. Like, it looks, this is going to be really harsh, it looks kind of like some AI pictures that I see, where it's just like randomly throwing things together with no concept of how things should actually look. So I don't think the visuals of this film have held up very well. And that's one of the few things I could say that I think Way of Water does look very good, and it looks much more tactile than this movie, much less, you know, rubbery globs of CGI.
No, I think you're right on the mark there, Nathan. I think that what we're kind of talking about is less about CGI than it is about art direction.
Mm-hmm.
That this movie has, the world that this movie envisions never really feels very real. It doesn't seem to have any kind of recognizable ecology, mm-hmm. or weather, or really anything other than, well, I mean, like you said, it's all just kind of there in these sometimes conflicting designs of creatures or terrain or flora smushed together. I think that the best example of this, and something that I even noticed when I was watching the movie, is the first time Jake is kind of like out in the forest of Pandora, excuse me, and he finds those flowers that shrink when they touch, when mm-hmm. they're touched. They looked so out of place where they were. It's not like, I don't think in real life you would see a self-contained, such a large self-contained patch of unique foliage like that. I don't think that if you just went out into the forest, you would see a perfectly contained circle of mushrooms.
Well, you might.
Well, okay.
Isn't that called a fairy's door? Isn't that actually a thing, though?
What?
I agree with you that everything feels like it's just randomly placed, but I don't agree with you that it looks unrealistic. I do think you find patches like that.
There's no such thing as a fairy door mushroom.
What's it called? It's a fairy circle? It's definitely a thing.
All right, fine, whatever. So that was a bad example, obviously. It looks weird.
Yeah.
It doesn't look right.
Well, and I think it's also, because I was thinking about this too, that like, I was comparing it to Star Wars in my head. That's another movie that, you know, Star Wars has a very generic sort of story. I don't think it's groundbreaking. I mean, a lot of people think he just fully ripped off Joseph Campbell's, like, archetypal hero story. So Star Wars has a very generic story at its center. But what makes Star Wars exciting is how well-characterized so many of the villains are. That Darth Vader is an iconic villain. That even though he's not the most, you know, deep sort of character, he has a great design, he's got a great voice, he looks very intimidating. Quaritch is just some dude. Like, there's nothing discernibly interesting or unique about Quaritch. The Death Star is an instantly engaging and exciting science fiction concept. It's a giant planet-destroying space station. That's great. Avatar is not. Star Wars very famously, to me at least, I don't know if this is famous to everyone, George Lucas really campaigned for the idea of a lived-in universe, that he wanted all of the costumes to be dirty, he wanted all of the sets to be dirty, because he wanted it to really have a sense that, yeah, real people lived here. And I think the jump to CGI did not help the lived-in universe concept, because Pandora doesn't look lived-in. Pandora looks like it was all created by a CGI artist, which is what it is. You know, it's hard to make a tree look dirty if you have to make every tree look dirty. If you have to make everything look unique, that's really difficult in a CGI space, especially when you're not being paid very much, because CGI artists have it tough. But yeah.
I'm glad you brought up the antagonists, because I'd like to read for everyone's enjoyment one of my notes here. Why are all these antagonists so effing one-dimensional? So again, pure Shakespeare. The antagonists are just laughable. And speaking of laughing, let me give you an example of the guy that, again, another stereotype. excuse me.
Bless.
Whew, thanks. The guy who doesn't trust Jake. There's a scene where Jake is trying to tame a pterodactyl. It's not a pterodactyl. It's some kind of winged monster. I can't remember what they're called, so I'll call it a pterodactyl. And he almost falls off. He's knocked off a cliff and he's hanging there. And it cuts to a shot of this stereotypical mistrustful guy and he's laughing. And that just makes me roll my eyes, because that's such an exaggerated, cartoonish villain thing to do. And dude, the shot of Quaritch where he's watching Home Tree fall down and he's taking a long sip of his mug, I was like, he may as well be twirling a curly mustache here. That's how just unbelievably, yet cartoonish these villains are. And the unfortunate thing is, them being cartoonish doesn't even necessarily mean they're unrealistic. Like, I know that people today, I've seen news stories about tweets of people being like, oh, the Native Americans, Stone Age society, we don't care about them. So that means that you can do whatever you want to them. So they're not unrealistic, but the unfair thing about fiction is that sometimes you do have to kind of go above and beyond what people are like in the real world.
Yeah.
Like this over-exaggerated picture of corporate greed and racism is so unengaging, and it just comes across as desperate. Like, maybe they're not even they're zero dimensional. That's what the antagonists are. Like the guy yelling, "They're flea bitten savages who live in a tree. They can find another tree." That's such a terrible line. Because again, this movie has a huge problem with telling and not showing. And that you could put that in a textbook of screenwriting mistakes of like, hey, don't do this. This is telling and not showing. This is literally the audience, the character turning to the audience and saying, yeah, I'm a racist scumbag who doesn't really understand how culture or civilization works.
Yeah. I don't have much to say. Before I do my ratings, Elliot, are you going to agree or disagree that Revenge of the Sith looks better than this movie?
Oh, I think that it has a more appealing aesthetic than this movie.
Yeah.
That's just because the Star Wars aesthetic is a very dynamic and engaging one. There are times where Revenge of the Sith looks very good, like at the beginning when the initial assault on General Grievous's ship looks very nice. But then the shot of Anakin and Obi-Wan leaving the council meeting after Anakin has been rejected for the rank of Jedi Master. Or what is it? Is he? He's on the council but not a master? Or
yeah,
is he a master but not on the council?
He's on the council, not a master.
Okay, so after that, the shot of them walking through the corridor, I've always, even when I was a kid, thought that shot looked terrible. So there are moments, I would say that the worst moments of Revenge of the Sith are worse than in Avatar, but if you like charted them on a line, on average, Revenge of the Sith is higher than Avatar.
Okay, good. I agree. I do. There's scenes where everything is CGI in Revenge of the Sith that if you pause it, you're like, whoa, that's not Ewan McGregor. I've had very few positive things to say about this movie, but my final rating is not going to be like 0 or like 1 or something, because it's still, I guess, entertaining in the sense that I wasn't as bored as I was with The Way of Water. There's sections of this movie that I find very boring, but I still do think the final battle is interesting enough to maintain my attention. And I do find it really funny how badly written so much of this movie is. But it's just uninteresting. Like, this is a painfully generic story set in a painfully generic sort of world with, I would say, no amount of interesting technological leaps to make me even appreciate it as, like, a historical artifact. Because, I think there's other movies that were way more influential way earlier than this, in terms of setting the tone of, hey, look, if you put two guys in front of a green screen, you can do anything. Like, again, for good or for bad, I think there were other movies that came out before this that were more influential, that deserve more recognition than this one. Or flipping Speed Racer. Jeez Louise, guys. Why are we going to the late 2010s when Lucas was doing this in the early 2000s?
Hey, speaking of early 2010s, this movie's got copious amounts of slow motion. Love it.
Yeah, I didn't even mention that. Yeah, the slow motion is weird. The choice for the cinematography, I did think this was interesting, to be kind of a, I don't know what the actual technical term is, but like a documentary feel, where like they use zooms or they use very like blatant camera sort of movements to make you think that what you're seeing is being filmed with a real camera, I guess. I don't know. I feel no particular way about that choice. assume it's to try and get us to be more absorbed in the world. It did not work for me. Anyway, my final rating.
I can't even summon to mind an instance of that happening, of like documentary style filmmaking.
It does the Zoom things that like Bigelow does in The Hurt Locker a couple times. And it does a lot of handheld stuff that, in my mind at least, is the intention is to make it feel more like it's filmed with a real camera, and by extension, make it feel more like it's really something that's really happening, that you're really seeing. You know, like if you watch someone record something on an iPhone, it's not going to be very steady. There might be weird zooms or like stuff like that. And so you know, like, oh, that really happened. So I think it's a similar sort of technique to try and get it similar.
Well, I don't remember any of that. Although, again, I think there's a huge disconnect between the movie wanting you to be so incredibly immersed in this world and the world being so shallow and so manufactured. Also, I just want to say the slow motion is in such weird places. Like the first time Jake is out flying a pterodactyl, he gets attacked by the Turok and it goes slow motion. Like the Turok kind of like comes onto the screen and then it goes slow motion, when in my mind it would be much better for that to play out at normal speed, because then you would have the bracing shock of the sudden change in the character of the scene from just kind of flying around to now it's a chase. So that's weird. What are you doing, James? Jim.
Anyway. Jim. Anyway, my rating's a 4.3 out of 10.
Okay. Yeah, I think this movie's not very good. I would even say it's pretty bad. It's not as bad as What Follows It, although I maintain that it would... I want Jim to make the same movie again and again. Like, I want Fire and Ash to follow the exact same plot as Way of Water, of them going to a new tribe, struggling to fit in, learning all the rules, and then having to leave after a climactic showdown, because I think that would be hilarious. I would watch that on DVD. I wouldn't go to theaters for it, but I think that would be really funny, so keep doing that. But for what we have in front of us, which is the first movie, I mean, I said last week that The Royal Tenenbaums is a movie without a soul. Here is a movie without a soul. Avatar.
Wow. Thank goodness.
I want to apologize in retrospect for calling The Royal Tenenbaums soulless, because this is what truly soulless filmmaking looks like. There's nothing original about it. There's nothing engaging. It's as deep as a puddle. And yeah, I really can't think of anything that I enjoy about it. The best thing I can say about it is that it's distracting, right? It will take your mind off your troubles for like 2.5 hours. Whereas The Way of Water will only amplify them. Because now you'll be thinking like, oh man, my life sucks and I'm watching this terrible movie. But yeah, I'm giving it a D-.
Good. All right, well, let's get to recommendations. I was tossing around a couple of different ones. The one I'm going to land on is I'm going to recommend Denis Villeneuve's Dune Part 2. Came out this year. If you have not watched it yet.
Oh my gosh.
First
it came
of
out
all,
this year.
Yes, it did come out this year. If you have not watched it yet, first of all, you missed out hugely by not seeing it in theaters, but absolutely pick this movie up. I think everything that people say in regards to Avatar, I would attribute to Dune Part 2. It looks astonishingly good. I feel pretty confident in saying that it's going to look really, really good 10 years from now, but I could be wrong. I, you know, who knows what'll look good in 10 years. It looks fantastic. The story is so interesting and engaging. The world is so well thought out and lived in and amazing. And the story, honestly, I would say is like a good version of this story, where it's pulling at interesting threads of, you know, what is the threat when someone achieves some mythological thing. I think it's very telling, you know, in Avatar, when the guy achieves a mythological event, the native population is very excited and rallies behind him. When the same thing happens in Dune Part 2, there's a sense where it's like, oh, shoot, like, we're kind of screwed here. Like, we really messed it up. I would say Dune Part 2 is the interesting version of an Avatar-esque story. And it was written 50-some years before this movie came out. So, kind of embarrassing that he released the uninteresting version of a story we already had the interesting version of. But it's so, so, so good on every technical level. It is such a hugely enjoyable film. I went to it with people who had not seen the first one, and they really loved it. So I think even if you haven't seen the first one, absolutely you should watch this.
I agree. I can give that a hearty second. I was considering recommending Dune Part 2. So,
oh, okay.
Yeah. My recommendation, I'm going back to something that I've already done before. I apologize. But I really couldn't think of a better example of this clash of this culture clash between two very different peoples that was actually done with maturity and intelligence and thought and good CGI than Dawn of the Planet of the Apes.
Yeah.
Honestly, this movie is in my top 10 of all time. I think it looks fantastic. The story is so good, and the characters, not a one-dimensional, very few one-dimensional characters.
That one guy, yep.
Very few, only one one-dimensional character to be found. Everyone else is so good, is so well realized. They have so many layers to them. This movie is honestly kind of like the exact opposite of Avatar, in that it's really, really thought-provoking in its exploration of the culture clash. Its antagonists are both fantastic and very much three-dimensional. Koba is one of my favorite villains of recent movies, and Gary Oldman's character, I mean, at no point does he do anything that you cannot 100% understand and almost get behind. The CGI looks incredible. The acting is amazing. It's got a really good soundtrack by Michael Giacchino. Watch Dawn of the Planet of the Apes. That's where it's at.
Yeah, that's a great movie. It was in our top 10 favorite movies of the last decade when we did it, by unanimous decision. Right? We did not receive it. There was no deliberation for that film. It made it in the first round.
You know what else is unanimous? The fact that life is hard and full of disappointments.
Yeah. Well, we should apologize to Davis for slandering his favorite movie for a little over an hour. Hopefully you still, you know, get us a good present for the family Christmas or whatever. But thank you so much for sending in an email. If you too want to send us an email and then have us rip apart your favorite movie, the email is in the description of the episode. It's in the description of our podcast. Be sure to shoot us some EM to interact. I couldn't think of a fun, hip way to say email.
Yeah, you may want to just call this one off.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for listening. We're going to be back next week with another exciting new episode discussing a movie. Maybe we'll have some thoughts on FFC's Megalopolis. We'll see. But have a great week in between.